Hello, everyone. Welcome to our Project Echo Virtual Community of Practice, session six. This will be covering mass casualty overview, medical surge, and load balancing. Just as people are entering, I would love to get a sense of kind of what your area of practice is. So please take a minute and just answer these poll questions if you can. And then we'll give people a few minutes to get settled and we'll get started right away. Hey, I'm just going to introduce myself. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Meg Aldrich. I am trained in internal medicine and pediatrics and infectious diseases, and I serve as the pediatric hospital epidemiologist for NYU Langone Health System and Bellevue Hospital Center. And I also work with NSPS Region 2 ReSPECT as the PEDS epidemiology support for the special pathogens program at Bellevue. And I am the lead for these series of virtual communities of practice through Project Echo and through the University of New Mexico. And I'm very happy to have everybody here with us today. A few housekeeping things. We do ask if you are able, once we get to the discussion section, if you are able to be on video to make it a little bit more of a conversation, we would really appreciate that. It also helps me a lot if I'm facilitating any questions. If you can change your name in Zoom, just so that I know what your name is, but also where you're coming from. If it's New Jersey, New York, if you're a hospital, you know, what your affiliation is. That just helps me know who the audience is, who I'm talking to. So I would really appreciate that. We do have most participants are muted until we get to the in 15, 20 minutes, we'll open up for more of a conversation. So until we get to that point, we're going to keep the mute on. And then I think, Amanda, are we pretty good with the poll? What do you think?
I
Should
think
we end it?
so. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so we have so far 210 participants. About 84% of you have answered our polling question. So I'm just going to share with you where we're all coming from, so we get a sense of what our audience participation is. We're about 48% public health, 18% in hospital clinical care. We've got about 4% EMS and 2% outpatient primary care. 20% of participants are emergency management, and then we have an other category. Not sure what that is exactly, but we do have a fair number of participants, about 65%. Have not had experience managing a mass casualty incident, which is totally fine and great. And hopefully today will help everybody feel a little level set and ready to handle whatever's coming our way in the summer when we're taking on FIFA. Okay, so we have two subject matter experts with us today. I am very happy to introduce Dr. John Hick, who is currently a faculty in the emergency physician department at Hennepin Healthcare and serves as a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School. He also serves as the deputy medical director for Hennepin County Emergency Medical Services and medical director for emergency preparedness at Hennepin Healthcare. In addition to serving as assistant medical director for LifeLink through Aero Medical Services, he also has a lot of sort of outside academic medicine work that he's done with Asper Tracy, and I'm really excited for him to share his expertise with us today. In addition, we're welcoming Kelly McKinney, who currently serves as the Vice President of Emergency Management and Enterprise Resilience at NYU Langone Health. He previously served as Deputy Commissioner at the New York City Office of Emergency Management and Chief Disaster Officer for the American Red Cross in Greater New York. And I, you know, just am so honored to be able to sit on the Zoom with these two people because I was calculating the math. And between the two of them, there's over 50 years of experience. So I think, you know, I feel very humbled to be in their presence, and I'm really excited to learn from them today. So we will start with a scenario. Amanda, can you advance the slides? We have no disclosures. And for CME, just for people to know, these are our learning objectives: reviewing the background and context of medical surge, reviewing specific points around FIFA prep, and thinking about strategies for healthcare organizations or practice settings to prepare for medical surge. Next slide, please. So we will start, hit the ground running. We have a clinical scenario. During a large protest in Central Park, there is a perceived security threat that leads to a rapid crowd surge causing stampede conditions. This results in a mass casualty incident involving 300 people of various ages with various levels of injury. So I will ask our visiting experts first, just jumping right in. When you hear a scenario like this from your background and perspective, what are some of the things that really worry you off the bat? What are you thinking of? What do you think could pose a challenge in terms of a scenario like this? Maybe start with John.
Okay, I was going to say, let's start with Kelly. I mean, the first thing obviously is scene safety. What caused the stampede, and is there, a realistic security threat? Is there a device, or anything? And so EMS is going to have its hands full on the scene. Assuming that there may have been some on the ground, framing up by EMS and law enforcement of an incident command system, if the protest was going on for a while in Central Park, just making sure that, that ties in with the larger response very closely. The problem here is that you can have a lot of very severe injuries. Looking at the Hillsborough, soccer incidents, for instance, that stampede killed 97 people. And so there are a lot of potential here. Now, the good news is that in a quote unquote conventional incident like this, you're looking at about a 85% minor injury versus 15% major injury, and a lot of the deaths are going to occur immediately, and so that's helpful. The problem is the people that are most likely to present to EMS and to the hospitals first are going to be the minor wounded. So you're going to clog up a lot of resources, and EMS is going to have trouble accessing a lot of the more critically injured victims because of the pressure of the lesser injured on those systems and on those services. But at the end of the day, a lot of this is going to be about getting, the EMS care and transport to the right people quickly, and getting them to the hospitals where hopefully they preserved enough capacity and shunted off, the walking wounded to the degree possible to maintain, resuscitation capacity. But most of these in the end, if you follow that 85-15 rule, I mean, we're maybe looking at, 45 with significant, looking at yellow or red category of injury. So that's, I am always, pleased is really a wrong word when we're looking at disasters, but when it's not an incident of mass violence, a bombing or a mass shooting or things where we expect a much higher level of acuity, these type of conventional incidents fortunately pose much more of a logistical threat from a hospital standpoint, than they do a threat that we're really going to overrun, resources. It's about figuring out where we care for them and not how do we possibly care for this level of acuity and this number of victims. Thanks.
Thank you. How about you, Kelly, from an
Yeah.
EMER standpoint?
Well, this is a very familiar and plausible scenario for us. We are just we're very near to Central Park here on East 34th Street and First Avenue, and our main campus and Tisch ED. So we use this sort of scenario a lot in our planning and our training and our exercises. But I agree with John about the nature of the injuries and the and you know this you know this type of crowd surge incident is it's very challenging, but the fact that it's in Central Park and there isn't a you know there aren't solid walls that are going to compress that crowd together and cause the kinds of catastrophic injuries we saw in Seoul in 2022, for instance, in that Halloween crowd crush. I agree with John that lots of those injuries will be yellow tags and green tags. And so, but at the same time, it's going to be a very difficult scene operationally. Central Park is 900 acres of woods in the middle of Midtown, and the roadways around it will be crowded not only with pedestrians, but emergency vehicles, etc. So it's going to be a very difficult and challenging scene to manage from an FDNY standpoint. So I don't think we can assume that their protocols would be implemented, you know, to a T, for instance. And those patients are just going to present, right? They're going to go wherever they can, and there are lots of EDs in very proximate to this site. You know, Mount Sinai West, Mount Sinai Morningside, Mount Sinai Hospital, and then we are also very close. But so we will see lots of patients from this. Bellevue will see lots of patients from this, and it's definitely a surge scenario for us.
Great, thank you. And I do want to take a minute. We do have some of our local expert residents from both New York City Department of Health. Mary Foote is with us, and we have from New York City Emergency Management. We have Rob Bristol on the line, and we also have from New Jersey. We have Dan Kezar, the program manager and deputy director of operations for the Office of Emergency Services for New Jersey. I would love to give you all a chance, if you feel you can and want to unmute. Just thinking about this scenario from your vantage point, you know, are there any things that jump out at you just off the bat? Things you're worried about? Things that this kind of situation, you know, would make you think, okay, we should be thinking about this particular issue. I don't know, Mary, do you want to chime in?
I know. I think we covered it pretty well. I think the biggest concern then is just kind of tracking the people that are going to be walking to the nearest healthcare facilities and trying to be able to, from a surveillance perspective, you know, in the public health side, that's we'd be kind of looking at our surveillance systems to try and track that and provide situational awareness to our partners.
Rob, any additional thoughts from your vantage point? And Dan in New Jersey, any thoughts for you? This, you know, there isn't quite a, when you're thinking statewide in New Jersey, Central Park, it's a little bit of a, it's a very New York scenario, but this certainly could be Liberty State Park. There's could be Branch Brook in Newark. There's a lot of other opportunities in New Jersey to have situation like this. Could even be the MetLife Stadium, the New York New Jersey Stadium. Not sure if there's any specific perspective from New Jersey that you would bring to a scenario like this that you would want to share with the group.
Sure, I think New Jersey's fairly unique in this type of situation, especially with the city atmosphere, right? New Jersey, we don't have the whole state as that city type atmosphere. And thinking about this scenario actually makes me think more of the rural areas of New Jersey, specifically like our reservoirs or camping grounds that are heavily populated during the summer months. And the concern there would be, you know, the hospitals are not very close to those facilities. So it would require additional transportation, making sure that we're looking at our hospital capabilities and the trauma centers or designations. And especially something like this, you definitely have to take into account the pediatric side of things. And where those hospitals do have pediatric capabilities. And not just that, but also the transport capabilities of getting those specific higher acuity patients to the most appropriate hospital. There's some areas in the state, for example, like our northwestern area of the state, where their closest trauma center is probably about a 40-minute drive by ground. And sometimes their closest hospital, for that matter, is about 30 minutes by ground. So a lot of that we have to take into account and rely heavily on our education, awareness of the state, our hospital status and bed counts, et cetera, and the capabilities of our units.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I find because I practice in New York, I'm very New York City centered, but you know, the needs and the sort of the way that you would approach some of these issues is going to be different, right? When you're in a more rural setting. And I think it's important for us to really think about all of the scenarios that are possible.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you. Next slide, Amanda. I'm just going to take a few minutes. As we do have a really mixed audience, we're going to spend just 3 or 4 slides just on some very general teaching points, which I'll share, and then I'm going to really turn it over to our subject matter experts to walk us through some a little bit more of the detail that we might need to prepare ourselves. 1 second, I have a timer on my light, and it always chooses an inopportune moment. So the first thing I just want to bring up is, you know, how do we define medical surge? And really, I look to ASPR for myself because this is not my area of expertise, and I really wanted to educate myself. So ASPR has a lot of really great resources, which we're sharing at the end of this presentation. But medical surge is really describes the ability to provide adequate medical care, evaluation and care during events that exceed the limits of normal medical infrastructure of an affected community. So really, we think of this as surge capacity and surge capability. Surge capacity is the ability to respond to a markedly increased number of patients, and capability is the ability to address unusual or specialized medical needs. Strategies to enhance medical surge capacity and capability really require a systems-based approach that is going to also require interdisciplinary coordination. I think that's a really important thing, and a reason why this Echo session hopefully is a great opportunity to have some of that interdisciplinary connection being made across disciplines. Next slide, please. Mass casualty and/or mass effect incidents really create demands that often challenge or exceed the medical infrastructure of an affected community. And these incidents can be defined as a hazard impact that primarily affects the ability of the organization to continue as its usual operations, which mass effect is differentiated from mass casualty in that respect. And for healthcare systems, the usual medical care capability and capacity can be compromised, and the ability to surge can be prevented. Next slide, please. And I thought it was really important for us all, because we're coming from sort of different geographic areas, to really think about where surge affects us, right? It could be pre-hospital, so that could be the emergency medical services, you know, ambulance capacity, hospital care, out of hospital care, so clinics, physician offices, patients might present to that kind of environment. But then also really thinking a lot about the support services. So laboratory, pharmacy, you know, medical supplies, do we have enough of the things we would need? Can we get more of the things we would need if we have surge? And then finally, there are things beyond even our immediate experience that are more infrastructure related. And certainly I know Kelly has a lot of experience with this, with Hurricane Sandy, but you know, infrastructure and jurisdictional issues, things around communications, power grid, water, security, transportation, that are really beyond the scope of like one institution, right? And that's going to require coordination with sort of the larger bodies that manage the infrastructure. Next slide, please. And when I was reviewing for this session, I really, one of the papers I looked at presented this. I thought it was a really very helpful way to think about things. Plan for what people will do, not for what you want them to do, which considering that for us in New York and New Jersey, July 4th weekend and the time right before and after is going to be a lot of stuff going on, it really made me think a lot about staffing and staff not being able to go to work for a variety of reasons, and thinking about that. How do you plan ahead for that? Family members will come to the hospital. Convergent volunteerism as a concept, you know, if there is an incident, a lot of providers might offer themselves to come and help, but you know, how do you manage that? Because not everyone has the skill set that you might need, sustained access to specialized equipment and personnel. So I really appreciate being a pediatrician, how Dan raised the point of a pediatric patient, and you know, are they going to get to a center where they have appropriate providers who can care for them, then the mental health impacts of mass casualty on both patients and staff, and finally, regulatory requirements, thinking about how do we manage, you know, the care that needs to be provided may not fit perfectly into what is our standard regulatory requirement. So I thought these were all really important things for us to really think about. And next slide with that, I think I'm going to turn it over to John to kind of walk us through poster model of sort of how to structure our planning around surge capacity.
Thanks, Meg. I appreciate those introductory remarks. You know, it is really interesting with convergent volunteerism. You know, we see this at the scene with EMS, you know, very well-intentioned people, but you know, a lot of times not really able to contribute, you know, help. I would caution, there is a special category of convergent volunteerism for the family support center and mental health support of individuals that will offer support for, you know, mental health for staff and for families after the fact. You have to be really, really careful with that. There's a lot of individuals that have agendas, and you know, if they're not known to you and not known through a system, and they're not providing a structured support or intervention, then no, sorry. We have had experiences with this on multiple occasions, including just with the Annunciation school shooting in Minneapolis here. So COSTER is a framework that Christy Koenig and I and a few others came up with years back. I still like it because I think it helps you think through from an incident command standpoint, what are the command elements, what are the logistic elements, and what are the operational elements that we want to make sure are accounted for in that first 30 to 60 minutes of an event. And we do have a COSTER poster that is available that's at the end. And I shared an updated version of that with Meg that is more colorful and has a lot of, you know, there's more detail under each of these headings, but we keep a copy of this up in our hospital command center just to kind of help the command staff orient in the first, you know, early first 30 to 60 minutes. So the incident command, you know, really needs to think about, you know, who's in charge, how do we integrate with and communicate with our partners in the community, whether that's EMS, public health, et cetera. And are there control factors, whether it's access controls for the hospital or other things we can put in place to limit, you know, the event? Is it a chemical contamination event? Do we have, you know, people trying to enter the facility from all of our entrances, which you will, including media, et cetera? So there's that element. And then we'll talk a little bit more, I think, Meg, on the next slide about the logistics of the space, the stuff, the space, and then the special considerations, as you mentioned, you know, is it a pediatric event? Are you going to need special equipment for that? Is it a chemical contamination event that I think Kelly's going to talk a little bit about that requires, you know, special, you know, equipment or approaches to the care of those patients. God forbid a radiation event. You get the idea. Systems can also go under S. You will see, you know, the four S's reflected a little bit differently. And that again reflects that you have to have intact infrastructure. And as Meg said, cascading failures, whether that's cyber, power, water, et cetera, are really common. And Kelly, and many of you have had very firsthand experiences, you know, some of those things. And then in the operations, you know, are we conducting the triage, the treatment, the transport, and the tracking of those patients? And transport can be either in between facilities if you're not a trauma hospital, but you're closest to where a mass shooting event happened. People are going to Google closest hospital and you're going to get people. So Desert Springs Hospital in Las Vegas, that is not a trauma center. They do a lot of outpatient orthopedic and other things. Got 93 gunshot victims on the night of the Harvest shooting. You have to be able to think about how do we redistribute those patients, you know, to the appropriate trauma care facilities within the hospital. How do we transport patients, but also family members? That was one thing again that we ran into after the Annunciation shooting was, One of the things we needed right away at the family support center as we matched up the victims, names with the parents, was to have escorts to get them to pre-induction waiting or up to the pediatric ICU or over to the emergency department. And that was not something that our plan had really incorporated very well. And then tracking within the system, I don't care how good your electronic process is within, your hospital for receiving, especially a lot of unidentifieds. I know you've got a lot of sailors coming for Fleet Week. It's like, well, I've got a, early 20s male with a, close cut haircut and, et cetera, in a sailor uniform. Okay, well, that's great. But I mean, if they don't have any ID on them, it's going to be really, really hard. You can get into a lot of, tattoos and other stuff for identification. But it can be really tricky. Same thing with our experience with school kids in uniform. So tracking patients within the hospital, you better have some paper backup, like a tag system or something else, a wristband system. But you've got to make sure that you have accountability for how many patients arrived, where they went, what's going on, and then just making sure that you've got an adequate amount of treatment resources. I worry a lot in the kind of situations that you all are facing, the first week in July, that if we have a mass casualty, getting an adequate number of staff into the facility could be really, really challenging. And you could wind up, back on your heels from a staffing standpoint, from there. I'll mention quickly about triage because it came up in the chat. I'm personally not a fan of start triage. I think it's okay for untrained personnel. I really like the UK's 10-second triage a lot better, to be honest. There have been studies, including one of our own on start triage, that showed, that basically some of the red category variables, like absent radial pulse, actually predicts a 70% mortality on arrival at a level one trauma center, and that in the yellow category, 26% of those individuals on arrival to our resuscitation bay needed emergency intervention. So I really prefer that people just stick with what they know, basic trauma life support and advanced trauma life support, ABCDE. And E, you need to include exposing that individual and looking for truncal penetrating injury, which is something that the 10-second triage from UK does incorporate START, and certain other systems do not. But again, that's just my preference. I don't find that, unless people are guided through START, or using it during a time when they're not under a lot of cognitive load, I don't find it's usable in disaster situations because, one, it requires too much counting. Two, people aren't familiar with it. And three, it doesn't actually do a very good job discriminating, the very injured from the lesser injured. So I'll get off my soapbox about that. But anyway, I hope that COASTER maybe gives you a little bit of a framework for thinking through in the early phases of MCI, where do you fit? And what are you relying on in those other columns, for assistance? If you're an ER doc, if you're an incident commander, who are you relying on to get these other things done? And maybe ask some questions in preparation about those areas to make sure you have the requisite supplies and things on hand, the callbacks, you're comfortable you're going to get the staff in when you need to, et cetera.
I actually included, John, the COASTER poster, the next slide, just because I thought it's so helpful. And then, as John mentioned, for the group with the post session email, we will send a copy of this poster. And wherever you work, you can adjust it or modify it or use it for preparation if that's helpful. But I love how each of these domains kind of asks questions to help you think about, how do you think about that domain space, supplies, that kind of thing.
Great. Well, glad you found it helpful, and I hope others will as well.
Okay, and I think from there we can go to the next slide, Amanda. Oh, okay. So this is transitioning. We wanted to spend just a minute or two, couple of minutes to talk about, once you sort of assess what you need to prepare for surge, how do you test yourself? How do you test your system? We had a great talk a month ago just about drills specifically. I'll shout out Jory, who is from Bellevue, who I know is on this call today, but he did a nice session for our onboarding of level two sites about drills. But I wanted to give Kelly a chance to walk us through a drill and to kind of show us, like, how do we use this to prepare ourselves, for surge. Can you share your experiences with us, Kelly?
Yeah, I appreciate it, Meg. And So it's really about our MCI patient surge program overall. And we're a large academic medical center headquartered in Midtown Manhattan. So there are lots of people around us. There are 8.5 million people in the five boroughs. There are about 15 million people in the greater tri-state area. And so the risks are there, where it's a threat-rich environment. And so there are we take this particular threat very seriously. And so we do have a robust program at all of our hospital campuses for all of our emergency departments. I'm going to give you one example, and I'm focused on just one element of the program, which is the exercise itself. And it really has to do with the fact that we believe in richly detailed scenario-driven simulations in order to create awareness and to build muscle memory and capability on the part of the teams that are involved. Because the teams, our emergency medicine teams are really they are best in class. They are exceptional in so many ways. The challenge of a mass casualty incident is this need to think differently, right? For the operations to pivot in effect when this surge presents itself. Next slide. So we partner with those emergency departments, and I just have to say the leadership there, that they dedicate their time to the planning, to the training, to these exercises, time that they really don't have. But it's because they understand what's at stake. They need their teams to be capable in the moment, and that's really the point of these exercises. You can see here, this is Reed Caldwell, our service chief for the Perelman ED in Tisch Hospital here in on the east side of Manhattan. And Reed in particular has been a great partner for us. Next slide. So we involve so many different departments, really every department in the hospital. Next slide. But it's beyond that as well, right? So you see some of the elements of the exercise, but it really has to do with how we create awareness on the part of not only the team that's confronting that surge itself, that clinical team in the emergency department, but all the other support departments throughout the hospital and throughout the enterprise, throughout all of our hospitals. Our job is to really create awareness around what the needs are, and so that we can support that team in the moment, because there will be a tremendous amount of resources needed. There will be staff, there will be stuff and space, as John pointed out. And so we have lots of the scenarios drive those, and we play them out in the exercise. Next slide. Often we will add this mass decon component, and we will have a full scale mass decon component with the mass casualty exercise, but not always. We have these drills and training separately as well. But if that event and this scenario that we're talking about here would likely not involve an environmental contaminant that would have a need for decon, but there are many scenarios that do. And so building this capability is also something that we work very hard to do. Next slide. So this is just an example of the Perelman ED. It shows those pathways and how we focus on those patients needing immediate treatment and those patients who can wait, and concentrate the clinical resources upon those immediate needs. Next slide. And for us and for the emergency management team, it really has to do with coordinating all of the different large pieces of the operation that have to come together. So that starts with the ED itself, so that the ED has this shared situational awareness of what's happening. There is a huddle that happens quickly, at the nursing station, and that's where those assignments are made and the plan is activated. And then meanwhile, we also are having a what we call a command post huddle with those support departments to give them awareness that this is happening. And that's where we're going to throw those resource needs and those staffing needs into those support departments so that we can bring, the resources of the enterprise to bear in support of the ED. And there are other critical coordination elements. There would be lots of external first responder agencies involved and city agencies. There would be a unified command set up, likely, at the scene in the street. We would have a coordination a liaison there so that we could communicate with that with the external agencies. We'd be working closely with Rob Bristol and his team at New York City Emergency Management if this was a Manhattan job. And then so that's really that external piece. And so those that's the emergency management piece. We partner with the ED to plan these things, and then we practice them in the exercise. Next slide. And we do use this START triage protocol. I hear John loud and clear. I mean, I think we've seen those challenges in the exercises. It's something that if you are trained on it, we think it does, it can be effective in identifying those patients that need definitive trauma care, in that golden hour. But there are challenges to it. It's not perfect. It is the standard around here. But, I'm gonna, John, I'm gonna follow up with you and get your ideas, because certainly two levels of triage is easier to implement than five. Next slide. Yeah, so that's the idea. I'll just close by saying, this is not we have the luxury of having the resources and the team to be able to do this. We're having one tomorrow at NYU Langone Hospital, Long Island. We will have 25 actors, live actors, moulaged, that we're going to push in all at once. And it is a very labor-intensive, expensive endeavor. We think it's worthwhile. But it, not every hospital has the resources to do it like we can do it here. And we understand that. But we do believe that, developing that scenario, convening those teams and dropping them into that scenario, even if you just do it, even if you just do it with, we have what we call sim men mannequins, a blow up, patients that we have used in the past. Oh, and then last thing, we work closely with the Sim Center at Bellevue. They're great partners, and we use those sim mannequins that are also really important for, they have patient vitals, and they bring a richness of detail to the clinical side. So that's it for me, Meg.
Thank you, Kelly. I really appreciate it, and I think this is our last slide, and I'd love to open it up to the participants to really, think about your particular practice location, and do you have questions? Do you have or would you? We've got these got a really a panel of experts here because we have our New Jersey and New York local experts as well. If people have questions, this would be a great time. Put it in the chat. But I will close with just sort of some special considerations. When we were preparing for this session, I was able to meet with John and kind of just pick his brain about like what are the things that you would think of for our region, Region 2, for a sort of confluence of events. We've got the military and FIFA and Fan Fest events, and then our regular June events, those kinds of things. So there's a lot of opportunities for people to come together. And some of the things we talked about were just high level, thinking about reunification plan, management of visitors arriving in the ER, requesting assistance, how do we manage foreign nationals, VIP patients, information sharing between healthcare and law enforcement, because there could be sensitivity issues around information sharing, and then civil unrest and management of riot control agents. So I really would love to kind of let John kind of pick out some of these, if there's anything in particular you'd want to flag for us, and then also open it up for the chat. Feel free to put some questions in the chat, or we can unmute the lines and people can raise hands and we can see if you, we can start a conversation in our last 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah, thanks, Meg. I think we talked a little bit about a few of these, and I do want to, make sure to draw attention to the fact that addressing the needs of foreign nationals and working with embassies, but also making sure you've got adequate translation services available. That's huge. There may be cultural practices that are issues. VIP management, and I use that in the broad sense because especially like FIFA or other big events like this, there's a lot of people that think they're VIPs and demand VIP treatments. But at the end of the day, you do need to have plans for managing legit VIPs. Some of you may need plans for managing the athletes. There's a lot there. For public health, I would also add, since we've got a lot of public health people on the line, food safety is a huge issue, during these weeks. It's hot. You've got a lot of events that are not official events, but they still are catered. For the Super Bowl we hosted, relatively recently, that fortunately was in the wintertime. So we didn't have, some of the temperature issues. But there were over 1,000, catered events involving multiple hundreds of people, during that week. And so foodborne, illness is just a massive issue, during these weeks and needs, some attention. I'll also say, and congrats to Kelly on, a comprehensive program. It is interesting to me that the hospitals that often have the most experience, with sort of devastating impacts, whether it's Hurricane Sandy or mass casualty incidents, are the most committed, to an emergency management program that is high quality because they've been there and they understand the risks. I will say on the, it was great to see everybody in their Tyvek 6000s and their Breathe Easy 10s there. Just remember in July, and Kelly's well aware of this, the ambient temperatures, and humidity may preclude any kind of long-term, operations in those suits. You're going to have to rotate team members through really quickly. But the good news is, for like riot control agents and things like that, those are nuisance agents, and a lot of things are gas. A lot of that is just clothing control. And so making sure that your emergency departments have big, clear plastic bags that you can rapidly get clothing into and get that sealed, is huge. Just make sure you've got gowns or redress kits to get those people, into. I'm a big fan, and I should have clarified at the outset, I'm not speaking for HHS today, not speaking for Independent Healthcare. It is not a testimonial for Sudocon wipes, but I do really like those for riot control agent. Unfortunately, Minneapolis, between George Floyd's murder and our recent ICE episode, have had more than our deserved share of experience with riot control agents. And I do find that Sudocon is, nice to have on hand. Otherwise, there's really not much you can do except, cold soap and water and time and air movement. But clothing control really is a big component. If somebody really gets doused, you really don't want your emergency department smelling like OC. So thank you.
Yeah, and we have some comments and questions coming in the chat, so I might open that up a little bit. We have from Afshin. Let's see, hold on, I had a question. Okay, from Isan Karaf, we have: is there a scenario or case where the green tagged are held outside the ED? Do they have to be sent to the ED? So that may be a question for you, John, as a sort of a clinical question. Clinical triage.
I mean, green still is injured. So I just want to differentiate between uninjured and green tagged, which is no anticipated life threat. So it really depends on your physical facility. If you are so small that you really can't accommodate them anywhere in the facility, it is possible that there is an external area where you could have them wait. It's much preferred to designate. For instance, in Las Vegas, they sent all of their walking wounded to the pediatric emergency department. I see Kelly had mapped out an area for, walking wounded. There's usually a designated area. It could be an area off of triage or conference room, wherever it happens to be. But understand where you're going to divert your green patients to. We have a outpatient ambulatory center directly across from our emergency department, and if we have a really large event, we'll decant walking wounded, over there. But Also, I'll just say be careful with quote unquote uninjured. If you do have like a mass shooting or a blast scenario, you can get a lot of blood on people that is not their blood. But make sure to, and we've started to carry a lot more body wipes, which are really good for dry decon, by the way, too. You can get rid of a lot of contaminant with just big body wipes. But wiping off that blood to make sure that that person isn't just adrenaline charged and doesn't realize that they have a shrapnel injury. Again, this happened in Las Vegas. It happened to us after Annunciation. We had a child who had blood on him from other children. He had a very minor appearing neck wound that the family didn't seek care for 4 days, but it turned out he had a piece of shrapnel that was adjacent to his carotid artery and had to be removed. So, getting the blood off of people at the scene to make sure that they're not injured is something that we focus on with our EMS personnel and also at the hospital, making sure we get people cleaned up enough and also check under the arms. Torso injuries don't occur in an anatomic position. People can be in weird bent over running positions, et cetera, when they're hit. And so, you got to find those wounds because very subtle looking wounds can be life threats and can very quickly move you from a green to a red category. Thanks.
Great, thank you. And then we did have a question that may be for our local points of contact. This is a question coming from Robin Key. Are there any plans to communicate emergency protocol contact numbers for small emergency centers that are not hospitals? So that might be a question for Dan in New Jersey or Rob and Mary here in New York, just about sort of preemptively communicating with smaller places, urgent cares, things like that, I think is what the question is. So I might let you guys speak to that.
So in New Jersey, a good portion of our urgent cares do fall under the umbrella of a hospital system, whether that's through Robert Wood, Hackensack, Meridian. There's quite a few urgent cares throughout the state that have that parent quote unquote hospital system that they do fall under, and they have those resources readily available for them. As far as we know, there are a couple of those, private, more urgent cares like Med City or what other names that are out there, and that's something that we would hope that are and definitely reach out to our county coordinators to make sure that those types of resources are available to them through that mechanism. To kind of sort of shift slightly in the previous comments, something that we're doing with FIFA, we want to make sure that we're also well aware of our pharmaceutical industry, especially with those that are coming from overseas. As a practicing paramedic myself, and being accustomed or seeing some medications from foreign countries, it's not something that everybody sees every day, and it's very important to make sure that we have that relationship with our pharmacies, and whether it's our poison control or the pharmacies directly, so we can ensure that that we're treating the patients as best as we can, especially in the trauma situation. If you have somebody come across that's on blood thinners, but we're so accustomed to the Eliquis that are out there or something, but it may be called something else overseas, and that could be a decision factor on which hospital we're transporting to, whether it's a trauma center or if it's our local hospital, even if it's a simple fall with a slight head contusion. So we're just keeping a lot of the ancillary things that you may not think about every day in mind, and making sure that we don't lose focus of those going through FIFA.
And just on the city side for emergency management, relationships with the urgent care sector is something relatively new. So we're continuing to build out how that will work during a real-world emergency. However, we do have a repository of all the urgent care centers within New York City, and can use that as needed.
Great, thank you. There's a question in the chat for Kelly. Does NYU have MOUs from NYPD to provide a perimeter security and support if decontamination procedures are being initiated, mitigation for secondary attacks on soft targets like hospitals?
Yeah, and we don't have specific separate MOUs with NYPD, but we do work with Rob and New York City Emergency Management and NYPD itself at a precinct level often to create awareness around the need for that, right? That is going to be a huge need. Michael's exactly right. And so, and we exercise that. We exercise that in Nassau and Suffolk counties at our hospitals out there. And so it's a really good question. And Meg, if I could, there was also a question about activation protocols.
Yes. Yeah, that was
And
from Kobe.
yeah, and you know, I would just say, you know, one of the things that we as emergency managers do is, you know, we work our incident management protocol. So 24/7, 365, you know, we're watching. And so this scenario, for instance, that happened in Central Park, one of the I guess good aspects of it is we would see it long before we receive patients because we're watching, right? We would have a situation room stood up or an EOC stood up, and we would see this incident unfold. And that is true all day, every day. And so, and then we are on the hook to work with the leadership of the ED to activate them as quickly as possible to the threat. We also have in New York City, thanks to Greater New York Hospital Association and New York City Emergency Management, we also would be receiving text messages and emails from FDNY itself. They're called MCI level A, B, and C alert. So that also would help to activate us. And so activating early and allowing the ED to make that pivot and to convene and to bring folks down and also to decant that ED to make space for those patients that are coming in. We think that's key. And that's all and you know, Kobe's exactly right. We have that all in written protocols that we practice. I mean, we practice, you know, our incident management protocol every day.
Great. And thank you to folks for putting questions in the chat. I am mindful of the time. We're coming down to the end of the hour. So are there any final questions from our participants? Feel free to put them in the chat. And then I might just go through from our local to our national visitors here and just see if you have any final words, sort of generally on this, anything you want the participants to sort of take home. Dan, can I start with you on that? Is there anything in regards to prep that you would want to share with the group?
Just make sure that we're keeping that open line of communication. Communication is key, especially to an event of this magnitude and a lot of unknowns as to, you know, what our population in this area is going to increase to. We have some general ideas, but having that communication, especially with your local, state, and federal partners, and making sure that information is getting shared, as much real-time data as we can get, throughout the state so that. For example, in the healthcare world, if we have something pre-hospitally that we needed to be aware about when it comes to communicable disease, that we're sharing that information with our local law enforcement as well, because they're the ones that are going out there as well. And just make sure that that communication doesn't stop.
Great, thank you. Mary and Rob, do you have any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I just definitely agree with the communication is obviously critical, and making sure that you know who the people are and the mechanisms are to get the situational awareness information, especially for our hospital partners and urgent care as well. Yeah, if you haven't done it recently, make sure that you have taken a look at your kind of internal protocols, especially your emergency notification protocols, your MCI protocols for your emergency rooms, et cetera. Now is a great time to take a look at that.
Great.
And for me, just highlighting, I answered this in text in the chat, but when it came to, you know, it was a question about reunification and central repositories. You know, the city has a reunification and FAC plan. It'll all be issued out via Notify NYC or WIA. You know, the plan is that we'll activate UVIS, which is a unified victim identification system that can only be activated at the direction of the police commissioner or the mayor. It instructs all public to call into 311 to report missing persons. And then it gets adjudicated by either OCME, NYPD missing persons, or et cetera. So, a big shout out to Greater New York, Andrew, and that entire team of about their kind of reunification series that has been ongoing. But just, to Mary's point, internal protocols and procedures, dust them off, make sure that you have plans to be able to enact some of these services at your facility while the city system gets up and rolling, and we can take relief off of that. And then just the communication piece, and a shameless plug for Notify NYC for all those folks within the city.
Great, thank you. And finally, Kelly, John, last words. I see someone in the chat right under the wire expressed my greatest fear, which is about staffing. If there's an event on July 4th, it's the weekend, it's the holiday, new residents in the hospital. In addition, events can be multifaceted, cyber attack, communications. So somebody spoke my greatest concern. How
Yeah,
about
and
for
I
you
think,
guys?
I think, and Kelly can speak more to this too. When you have new residents and you've got a very high profile event occurring, right away during, their initiation, essentially getting one pagers out and some specific but very brief info about what their role is, how they get notified, where they report, those sorts of things. Find somebody in a vest; they'll tell you what to do. Keep it simple, but you gotta give them the framework. Otherwise, they're gonna be calling. There's gonna be a lot of confusion. There's gonna be a lot of issues. I would really take, in addition, I'll just, footstomp what Mary said about take a look at your policies, take a look at your activation protocols, et cetera. Also, really take a close look at your supplies. We aren't seeing any current, really significant impacts of the war in the Middle East now, but that certainly, could continue to evolve. But even just from a traffic standpoint, there's been multiple mass shooting occasions where the closest trauma center has gone through well over 300 units of packed red cells. If you don't have adequate blood bank, resources, you may get less ability to
What do
replenish
we
those
think
over the
about
4th of July
freedoms?
weekend. So be thinking about that, and also just be thinking about kind of the usual stuff that you
You
run
think
out of. I mean,
it
airway
like
supplies,
did the
chest tube
urine
supplies,
seep the blood?
surgical supplies are a big
Yeah,
issue
I was
too.
gonna say.
So you got to be thinking if, great, you can open up 10 ORs, but if all you have is 10 major procedure trays, those take 2 hours to turn around in sterile processing. You may need to augment people like sterile processing during an MCI. And if you can't turn those trays around fast enough, you're going to be limited in the amount of major surgeries you can do. So follow those things through. Just think about, a bad trauma case, and then multiply that by 25. If you're a level one trauma center, just think what are the resources we're going to need downstream? And do we need to really increase power levels, increase staffing, do some other things, over the course of this week and weeks, to make sure that we're well positioned to respond? Because it's really tough once you get behind that curve. There's not things that you can really do to substitute. So good luck. These kind of special events are really, a dance with a tiger. I mean, beautiful animal and fun to look at, but you could get badly injured in the process. So, good luck, and it's a great opportunity to tune up your systems, meet a lot of partners, develop a lot of relationships that will serve you well during July and beyond. Thank you so much for the opportunity to participate today, Meg. And I did drop a thing in the chat about HIPAA and disasters. I think it's really important to understand that information sharing for purposes of reunification is exempt from HIPAA. So that's a really good thing to educate staff about ahead of time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I think Kelly probably had to jump off, but I'll just say that you will receive an email from us after the session. It'll have a link to the recording. Feel free to review that with your colleagues, with staff at your site. We'll also have the coaster poster available for use if you need it. And as always, reach out if you have feedback, special requests, questions, or any follow-up, and we'll do our best to answer those. Thank you everyone for joining today. Really appreciate it.